In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics. My name is Professor Eric McDaniel. Today I'm joined by Dr. Joshua Blank, who is the manager of polling and research for the Texas Politics Project here at the University of Texas. Dr. Blank, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So today we actually have quite a bit to talk about. So in regards to funding for certain epidemics, in regards to the Zika, as well as the opioid crisis. Then we have, of course, the 2016 campaign. But then we want to wrap up the discussion of kind of really a recurring subject for the past few weeks, and that is police community relations, specifically with the events of Baton Rouge this Sunday. But let's start off, what I want to start off with, the discussion of Zika funding. And this has been one of the big issues going on as of how to handle Zika. And well, we thought there was a plan, but the plan kind of fell through. And we have a clip explaining that.
$1 billion bill to address the Zika crisis has fallen apart in the Senate. Democrats objected to the measure largely because it restricted funding to Planned Parenthood. But Republicans insist the bill included plenty of effectively allocated funding. The president had requested nearly twice as much money. Congress had just two more weeks to reach a deal on Zika funding before lawmakers leave for a summer recess.
So as we see, this is kind of a crisis in which the parties really can't seem to agree on certain things. The Republicans are like, well, we're willing to fund it just up to this amount, but in order to fund it, we're going to take away certain resources. Specifically, the issue of Planned Parenthood is seen as kind of a deal breaker. And there actually have been some studies that's like, well, to what degree would this lack of funding actually affect some of the outlying territories, such as Puerto Rico, where Puerto Rico we expect to be in actually a hotbed for this. And you're seeing a lot of cases being developed in Puerto Rico. And they say, really, the Republican plan may not be as harmful as it looks. However, many people are opposed to this really because for symbolic reasons, especially in regards to Planned Parenthood.
And from a political perspective, I mean, this is the sort of event, I think, that just makes people hate Congress, right? I mean, this is the sort of thing where you say, well, you know, everybody should be on board here. For Republicans, they're protecting, you know, unborn children and newly born children who are the most vulnerable among us. And for Democrats, you know, we're going to put money into a public health campaign. I mean, it's sort of the sort of thing where it seems like a slam dunk, and then it's another failure. And this is kind of why congressional approval floats around, you know, 10%, because of sort of these sorts of incidents where there's no reason for it not to happen.
Yeah, and this is really important issues. You think, okay, this should be done. This is very simple. Everybody should agree upon this, but they find a way to disagree.
Now it's almost as if they seek out a way to disagree.
Yes, yeah. It's like, okay, how can we find a way just to not make this work? Now, one of the things I want to talk about is to what degree should people actually be worried about Zika, specifically coming from mosquitoes. So if you show this map from the CDC actually did some research, and the areas that are highlighted are the areas where we expect where the mosquitoes who carry Zika are most likely to be found. And so whereas before it was argued that, you know, Zika would spread all the way up to the Northeast, it's really going to be concentrated in the South. So California, Texas is going to get hit hard, Arizona, parts of New Mexico, Florida, but it can travel up, you know, to Maryland, places like that. So as far as this being a nationwide threat, the CDC doesn't believe that. It's going to be certain pocketed areas. A lot of people argue that, you know, it'll be going as far as Minnesota. You know, the Canadians will be protected. Just nobody wants to get Justin Trudeau sick. But really, we're finding really pockets in the South. And again, once you get to kind of middle of California, Northern California, you don't see that happening because those mosquitoes don't exist in that habitat. So we're finding that the threat may not be as large as we assumed in the continental U.S. However, in the U.S. territories such as Puerto Rico, which already has its own problems in terms of its economy, the problems may be severely worse. Now, while we can mention a failure in regards to funding for Zika, we have seen some success in regards to funding for opioid treatments. And so we have a clip discussing that.
It's been months of debate and delays, but today, Congress finally agreed on a bill to deal with the nation's growing opioid crisis. Channel 9's George Colley's in Washington and explains what the legislation includes and why some worry that's still not going to be enough.
Legislation to combat the nation's opioid and heroin epidemic is heading to the president's desk. It expands prevention and education efforts, boosts availability for life-saving overdose medicine, provides more treatment options for addicts, and strengthens prescription drug monitoring programs.
It's just changing the attitude. You know, this is the first time that the United States Congress has really gone on record saying addiction is a disease.
This is really important that the federal government is saying this is a priority.
Senators Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire and Rob Portman from Ohio represent two of the areas hardest hit by the crisis. A United Nations report finds heroin use in the U.S. is at a 20-year high. The most updated statistics are from 2014, and they show about 28,000 opioid and heroin-related deaths nationwide, with about 1,400 in Florida. Lawmakers are concerned because there is no funding attached to this bill. The president asked for more than $1 billion. Congress is considering appropriating about half that.
And we need to do more, obviously, to continue to fight to make sure that it's fully funded, and I'm going to be doing that and continue to do that. But this is going to make a big difference, I think, in this epidemic.
Congress will address the funding issue in the fall. The president is likely to sign the bill.
So here's an important thing. As I said, there's no funding. As we know, for a lot of bills, one is passing the bill, and the second is paying to actually carry that out. And so the appropriations bills are another thing. And this is another thing that frustrates people about Congress is there's so many veto points. And so even though the bill has been passed, there's no funding for it. So it's basically your parents giving you the car, giving you the keys to the car, but the gas tank is on empty. It's like, I got the keys to the car, but I can't go anywhere. And so this is one of the fears about this is that, yes, it's been passed, but will it receive proper funding? And this, again, as you know, as Dr. Blank pointed out, there are kind of the reasons why people dislike Congress is because there's so many ways to kind of impede something from happening. But there is one important point to make from this is that we're seeing a change in terms of how drugs are being framed. And so you're seeing a lot of people talk about the end of the war on drugs, of the idea of talking about addiction not being a criminal issue, but as a health issue. And this is important because it changes drastically how we treat these things. So later in the semester, we'll talk about policy, especially policy images. We'll talk about how policy images impact the tools that are used. When drugs are used, when drugs are seen as a criminal issue, it's in the hands of the Department of Justice, which is going to be criminalizing, putting people in jail. Whereas when it's a health issue, Health and Human Services, more about treatment.
Yeah, and I think what you can see here is this is part of a broader discussion from a couple of different points, right? I mean, one is the fact that, you know, when you look at a less serious drug than heroin, marijuana is legal in many states now. Let's say attitudes even in Texas are basically pro some sort of decriminalization of sort of lesser drugs like marijuana. At the same time, this sort of overcriminalization of drugs like heroin, crack, cocaine has led to sort of what a lot of people are looking at as kind of the justice system crisis, with minority groups being overly imprisoned over basically where minor drug offenses. There's a lot of elements, I think, going into this overarching change towards how people feel about drugs.
Yeah, and again, this is one of the crosses that Hillary Clinton has to bear, because we talk about these very harsh drug laws, specifically in regards to crack cocaine. It was, you know, part of it was during the Bush presidency, but part of it was also continued during the Clinton presidency as well. And she made some very harsh statements. And so she was an active combatant, or at least part of the administration was an active combatant in the war on drugs. And where black people are arguing that the war on drugs has actually been more of a civil war, which has harmed the public a great deal, specifically minority communities. And as Hillary Clinton tries to reach out to these communities and mobilize these communities, she has to reckon with the fact that she's made some decisions which has harmed these communities and made some very strong statements which are seen as inflammatory towards these communities. However, with that said, it is important to note this change we're seeing. And as we talk later on in the semester about policy, the way we define a policy, the way we define a problem dictates the policy. And so whereas in the past, drug addiction was defined as a criminal issue, by defining it as a medical issue, we're going to see drastic changes in the policies put forward. And this moves from a criminal side to a public health side, which means we should expect to see more money put into treatment. Now, again, to what degree this is going to happen for all drugs is not really clear. But we do know in the case of heroin, we are seeing much more work in regards to treatment as opposed to punishment. Yeah,
and something I guess I'm kind of interested in seeing how, looking forward to, I mean, and not looking forward to as an excited, but looking ahead, is, you know, if, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about police violence or violence against police, you know, a little bit further in. But, you know, if this sort of activity continues, at what point might this sort of idea of, you know, funding public safety and police potentially come into conflict with basically treatment, right? If it is one or the other is the way you can approach this, at some point they might actually butt heads because usually there's not money for everything. So it's something to look forward to, as I said, not in an excited way.
Yeah. I mean, again, the competing frames are extremely important to pay attention to in policy making. Now, continuing with this idea of competing frames, we move to the 2016 election, and we have some new. We have a new player in the 2016 election, and that is Donald Trump's VP pick. And the vice presidential selection was is Governor Mike Pence of Indiana. So many of you may wonder, who is Mike Pence? Well, I'm here to tell you. So he is the current governor of Indiana, and he served as a member of the House of Representatives from 2003 to 2013. And so he understands how Washington works. Now, one of the things about Pence that's extremely important is that he's a social conservative. So Trump had a little bit of problem winning over social conservatives. While he had evangelicals with him, many of his statements were, especially in regards to LGBT issues, were seen as not being necessarily socially conservative. And Mike Pence became famous nationally because of his religious freedom bill in Indiana, which allowed businesses to basically deny services to individuals because it conflicted with their religious views, specifically from having to serve food at same-sex marriages, things of that nature. However, he caught a great deal of hell for this. So the NCAA actually threatened to move tournaments out of Indiana. I think even the NFL threatened to remove a Super Bowl from Indiana. And so there's going to take a lot of businesses were going to move out of Indiana over this. He didn't change to make an amendment saying, you know, you can't do this to discriminate based upon sexual orientation. But again, he did gain a great deal of attention because of that and because he signed it. And he kind of did some backtracking, which people may not be happy about, but that's where he gained a great deal of notoriety. But in addition to this, he has good relations with Paul Ryan, as well as the big donors. One of the things that we talked about last week with the Trump campaign is, you know, they need the money. Hillary Clinton has a very strong fundraising arm in action. She's going to outspend Donald Trump quite a bit. And so he can help bring in the money, all right? So he can make it rain. But finally, one thing that people have pointed out is that he's facing a competitive re-election bid. So things haven't gone for him as well as he would have liked in the state of Indiana. The Democrats have found somebody from southern Indiana who refers to himself as a gun-toting, Bible-thumping southern Indiana Democrat who they think can basically match up with Pence on a lot of issues in terms of really social issues, such as gun control as well as religious freedom, but may have a different economic message that people in the state of Indiana may be open to. And so because of this, it may be a good time for Pence to step out. And so many people saw him as really the most likely choice. People also saw him as a viable presidential candidate. And so, you know, this is Mike Pence.
It's pretty good. It's a pretty good introduction. And I mean, you touched on a couple of the points of why, you know, why does any presidential candidate pick anybody, right? And I mean, I think some of that is filling in for weaknesses, right? You know, so his cachet with social conservatives, his relationship with House Republicans, with, you know, the legislative arm, who Donald Trump's relationship is, you know, strained, to say, you know, to take it lightly. You know, and also, you know, he's from Indiana, which is an important state, you know, in the presidential election. Republicans have been pretty, you know, successful with, but Democrats think that actually they have a good chance this year. I mean, Evan Bayh from a famous, you know, sort of Democratic political family is basically going to probably run for Senate there. It sounds like, you know, Democrats think this is a state that they can win, which is part of the reason Pence was all very happy to jump ship. But at the same time, why even having someone with those connections would actually be helpful for Trump. I mean, the next question is, how is it received? I mean, so the timing of this is right before the convention, and this is sort of pretty standard. I mean, one, he's going to have a speaking slot, so you have to eventually tell everybody who the vice presidential pick is going to be. But you know, secondarily, the idea is you want to build momentum into the convention. And so the you know, with Pence, you know, you're bringing someone in with all these assets that Trump doesn't have. But the thing was, and you know, there's so many kind of look for some weird clips on this. And there's a bunch of weird clips, but they're not really condensed. But their rollout was widely panned as being pretty ham-fisted. You know, they went on and did sort of their first Friday when Trump announced him. I think it was on Friday afternoon when he said he wasn't going to announce him on Friday because of the attacks in Nice. Then decided he was going to basically do this rollout. Goes out and basically talks about himself for a while, as he's wont to do, and then says, here's Mike Pence. And everyone's like, well, that was weird, you know? And then they did this very, very strange 60 Minutes interview where Trump mostly spoke over Pence, and at a lot of points basically admitted that they disagreed on most things and said, yeah, that's fine, which is not usually the way that, you know, presidential tickets are constructed. Usually the idea is they kind of reinforce each other's message and there's something consistent there, whereas their whole rollout was about how, in a lot of ways, they don't agree about things. So that kind of leads into the convention, right? Which is in Cleveland, Ohio this week. And you know, most of the media coverage of this, which strikes me as funny, the media coverage of this is basically treats Trump completely as a conventional candidate. And they want to evaluate him as a conventional candidate because they don't know how else to do it. And so the idea was, what's he trying to accomplish? And well, he's trying to accomplish party unity. He's trying to, you know, introduce himself to a wider audience. He's trying to you know, get positive media coverage, right? Because you control the convention, you control the content, and in some ways, you know, everybody's going to cover it. So you get 4 days of uninterrupted coverage. And we've done 2 days of this so far. Day one was somewhat of a disaster on these fronts. And day two seems to have been a little bit better. So let's go through that a little bit. So early on, you know, I said, if you're thinking about these goals, one of the first goals is party unity, right? And getting a positive media hit. So early on during the day, during his own convention, Trump called into Fox News, and we have a clip of that.
Yeah, we talked about this before. Most of that is education driven. Let's turn to the convention. The Ohio Governor John Kasich should be at the convention, is not. Have you spoken with him? How do you feel about that?
Look, I beat him very badly. I won 38 states. I won the highest number of votes in the history of the Republican Party. Second was very, very far away. I beat him very, very soundly. And you have to understand, this was a contentious, some people say the most contentious primary they've ever seen either party. If I were him and got beaten that badly, I probably wouldn't show up either. He has a problem, though. He signed a pledge. And from a standpoint of honor, I think he should show up. I also think this, if this were the Democratic convention, I think he should show up because it's good for Ohio. I wanted it to be here, and we had lots of choices. I wanted it to be in Ohio. I recommended Ohio, and people fought very hard that it be in Ohio. It's a tremendous economic development event, and you look at the way it's going so far, it's very impressive. I wanted it to be here. The Republicans wanted it to be here. But honestly, even if this were for the Democrats, he should at least show up and say hello and say, how are you doing? He got beaten very, very badly. He could have, you know, left. He should have left probably many weeks earlier than he did. But he just hung around.
Do you think he's being a sore loser?
Well, I don't want to say that. But you know what? It was a very contentious primary. He lost very, very badly. And maybe if I were in his position, I wouldn't show up either.
So as you recall, you know, John Kasich was one of the last two not, you know, candidates standing besides Trump at the end of the contest. He's the governor of Ohio, right? You know, he's an important Republican governor in an important swing state. And there's Trump basically, you know, basically calling him a loser over and over again. On Fox News, which is where, you know, most Republicans are catching their news. And this is, again, if you think about the goals we're talking about, party unity, okay, you know, not necessarily success. So the other piece of this, too, was that what he ended up stepping on was the convention coverage at that point was of the mother of one of the victims in the Benghazi attack. And, you know, it was basically widely said that this was one of the most sort of emotional and connecting pieces of day one. And he actually, you know, again, he has a pretty big hand in programming the content, and he actually stepped over it to kick a fellow Republican. And so that was, you know, the first piece of day one was, you know, what are they doing? The second piece of day one was Melania Trump giving her you know, sort of big debut speech, and she's not someone who has been on the campaign trail or talking a lot. And so this was her big, you know, introduction to people. The expectation was that she was going to come out, sand some of the rough edges of Trump down, you know, basically show people, you know, that, you know, he's actually a nice guy. And generally the response was, at first it was, well, that was an okay speech. I mean, there were no real personal anecdotes and everything, but she handled herself well. But then quickly the sort of storm came up about, boy, her speech sounded a lot like Michelle Obama's in 2008. And so we'll let you judge that for yourself with this clip.
You have the same values. Like, you work hard for what you want in life.
The values that you work hard for what you want in life.
That your word is your bond, that you do what you say you're gonna do.
That your word is your bond, and you do what you say and keep your promise.
That you treat people with dignity and respect.
That you treat people with respect.
And Barack and I set out to build lives guided by these values and to pass them on to the next generation.
And we need to pass those lessons on to the many generations to follow.
Because we want our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
Because we want our children in this nation to know that the only limit to your achievements is the strength of your dreams and your willingness to work for them.
So, you know, just to be clear, like, this isn't a big deal. Like, I mean, you know, in the grand scheme, this is like one of the kind of small things. It's going to be an anecdote. But the way the framing around this is about sort of the, you know, I think it's often described as reed thin structure of the Trump campaign. The fact that they haven't hired a lot of people, that they don't have, you know, sort of, I mean, basically, because most campaign, you know, sort of consultants who've been asked about this are basically saying, yeah, it's pretty basic to take any speech and just turn it, you know, use Turnitin or any sort of free plagiarism software to figure out, you know, if you've made a mistake. And, you know, this is kind of basic, and they kind of messed up. Now, the thing was is that, you know, earlier in the day, in an interview with Matt Lauer, Melania had said that she wrote it herself. And then at about 2 a.m, the Trump campaign released this statement, which I think is just, it's my favorite thing of the week. So I think we have a slide of it. It basically says, you know, in writing her beautiful speech, Melania's team of writers, so they've already contradicted what she said earlier in the day, you know, took notes on her life's inspirations and in some instances included fragments that reflected her own thinking. I just don't understand how a professional person can write this, because basically what you're saying is, so in some instances, the writing of her team of writers reflected some of her own thinking, which implies actually that most of what she says wasn't her own thinking. Now, is that really what they're saying? No, but this just sort of tells you what kind of day they had on day one, where, you know, the story basically became about how incompetent Trump's campaign team seems to be. So that was the day one coverage. Day two, they got back on track a little bit. And by getting back on track, it's mostly about, you know, focusing on what unites Republicans above all else, and that is their distaste for Hillary Clinton. And the most successful individual yesterday at doing that was probably New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. We have a clip.
Clinton, as an inept negotiator of the worst nuclear arms deal in American history, is she guilty or not guilty?
Guilty!
Next. Next. Oh, believe me, we're not done yet. The indictment is hardly complete.
Now, if you've been watching, you know, this convention from, you know, start to finish, more or less, as some of us have, me, you know, this was like the most excited the crowd has gotten the whole time, easily. I mean, most of it has been really muted and kind of noticeably muted. And I mean, that's kind of what you expect if we're talking about these issues of unity. And sort of the fact is there's a lot of delegates there who, you know, are not Trump supporters, right? And he hasn't really done much to win them over. This is a reminder of what most of the Republican convention probably is and is going to continue to be about, which is, you know, we may not agree on much, but we agree about what we don't like, and that's Hillary Clinton, right? And then, you know, the other couple major speakers from last night, Donald Trump Jr. Spoke in prime time, and you know, his speech was pretty well received, but it was also kind of notable because as a family member, usually you stay sort of out of the politics. You tell sort of those anecdotes about, you know, your father or your husband or whomever, and you try to soften the edges and help him with different groups of people. And he did a little bit of that, but what he really did was actually lay out a lot of policy, you know, talked about, you know, sort of school vouchers and the tax system. And then he also actually directly attacked Hillary Clinton, which is pretty unusual for a family member to do, because usually, you know, the family stays over here, the candidates stay over here, they deal with each other, the families are off limits. But, you know, it's going to be, but I mean, again, Trump, his family, his campaign is not traditional, it's not expected. And then the other major speaker of the night was Dr. Ben Carson.
So Dr. Carson kind of gave the, I guess, most interesting comparison of the night. Let's roll that clip.
Now, one of the things that I have learned about Hillary Clinton is that one of her heroes, her mentors, was Saul Alinsky. And her senior thesis was about Saul Alinsky. This was someone that she greatly admired and that affected all of her philosophies subsequently. Now, interestingly enough, let me tell you something about Saul Alinsky. He wrote a book called Rules for Radicals. On the dedication page, it acknowledges Lucifer, the original radical who gained his own kingdom. Now, think about that. This is a nation where our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, talks about certain inalienable rights that come from our Creator. So are we willing to elect someone as president who has as their role model somebody who acknowledges Lucifer? Think about that.
So I'm in my 30s. I don't really know who Saul Alinsky is besides like a boogeyman that we attach to like left-leaning politicians. What's he talking about?
Well, let me take the time to inform you.
Please.
So Saul Alinsky, as you'll see from the slide, Saul Alinsky was a Chicago-based community activist, a community organizer. And so again, the Chicago connection, Hillary Clinton being from Chicago, or is she from New York now? We never know. She's like Carmen Sandiego.
Or Arkansas.
Oh, that's right, Arkansas. She would never say woo pig suey.
She would if she had to.
She would if she had to, but yeah. But he basically provided a lot of tactics for influencing public policy and was really concerned about the poor. And he was a lot about community organizing, but also disruptive tactics, things like that, to try to get people's visions through. Now, again, Saul Alinsky influenced quite a few people, even King, others like that. And so he was a big leader when it comes to kind of these progressive movements, specifically in regards to the poor. And he was known as being anti-establishment. Now, the quote that Dr. Carson is referring to is the following quote, which we have a slide of. And this is actually at the very beginning of the book. So if you read the book, he actually starts off with a few quotes from one from a rabbi, one from another political philosopher. He says, "Lest we forget at least an over-the-shoulder acknowledgement that to the very first radical from all of our legends, mythology, and history, and who is to know where mythology leaves off and history begins, or which is which. The first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and to do so effectively that he had at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer." A lot of people said this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek type thing to kind of talk about how we often demonize people in politics. And so that's what's going on. Lucifer's not mentioned anywhere else. It's like really the first two pages. So if you read the first two pages, Lucifer, and then for the rest of it, there's nearly nothing else. It's about community organizing, about how we demonize individuals, things like that. Now, if you actually read Secretary Clinton's thesis, she met with Saul Alinsky once. And she met with him once for her thesis. And she said, you know, I agree on these few issues, but I disagree with his anti-establishment stance. And she actually wrote in her memoirs that Saul Alinsky invited her to work for him. She's like, no, I'm going to law school. And he said, you're wasting your time.
Obviously.
Yeah, obviously, yes. She's become such a loser. So that's what's going on with Saul Alinsky. Now, I'm not trying to defend Saul Alinsky or defend Hillary Clinton. It's just one of the things about it is whenever you have a convention coming, the fact checkers, basically the machines explode. Because there's so much stuff flying. Like next week when we talk about the Democratic National Convention, oh my God, the stuff that's going to come out of their mouths, you'll be shocked and amazed. And so it's just one of these things that I like doing is doing the fact checking, because when you do the fact checking, all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, these people are lying left and right or distorting things. And we're going to see the same thing next week. Please don't be surprised by that. But again, we'll talk more about Hillary Clinton and her campaign next week. But this is really important to really talk about how you see Ben Carson trying to frame Hillary Clinton, and specifically saying, you know, the idea that somebody, you know, mentioned Lucifer or tried to put Lucifer in a positive light, considering that this is, as he points out, you know, a nation that has a religious founding or maybe a Christian founding, and God we trust. How can you support Lucifer? Again, Alinsky is known for being antagonistic. I think even Hillary Clinton says he antagonizes everybody he meets. So he's kind of, he's that guy. He's, I guess, you know, I can't think of a great example of that. Somebody just antagonizes for the purpose of antagonizing, but he's that guy.
You know, and I just, you know, actually to kind of follow this up with one final point on the conventions, kind of, you know, there is this idea that you watch these things and every year I always think, boy, the way they speak, it's almost as if nothing happened, you know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago. Everything is really condensed into sort of the most recent time stretch. And it is sort of, you know, portrayed, you know, and obviously time, you know, creates more understanding of what's going on and that sort of thing. But it sort of feels like you hear just stuff that if, you know, you're a Democrat during the Republican convention, it makes, you know, your blood boil, and vice versa for Republicans during the Democratic convention. But the other thing to remember, like, as far as the purpose of this goes, is this isn't about necessarily speaking to the other side. This is about speaking to their group of Republicans in this case. And next week it's going to be about Democrats speaking to Democrats after a long primary process and reminding them, hey, we agree about a lot of things. You know, I think Mitch McConnell spoke earlier in the day yesterday. He made a really good case. You know, actually, it was very, you know, I mean, he got booed coming up, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, you know, partially because he's seen as, you know, being part of the establishment, I think, among probably other things. But, you know, he came up and he made the case, look, you know, here's a bill that the Republican Senate and the Republican House have passed that I know that everybody in this audience agrees with. You know, Barack Obama has vetoed it. Donald Trump will sign it. And he went down the list. And look, it wasn't, you know, a ringing endorsement of Donald Trump or, you know, I believe in his ideology or his ideology is my ideology or we all agree. But it was making the case, look, we mostly agree with ourselves. And it's the same thing with the Democrats you're going to see next week. Even if you were a diehard Bernie Sanders supporter, you're going to come in, you're going to say, boy, most of what these people are saying, I agree with. And that's what happens is, you know, a lot of people haven't been paying attention to this. They haven't been watching this go on for a year. And now they're getting invited back into the process and they're being reminded, oh, yeah, I'm a Republican. Or, oh, yeah, I'm a Democrat. And that's a lot of what is going on here. So, I mean, the fact-checking is sort of this thing where it usually frustrates the other side a lot. But the reality is they're just speaking to people who agree with them anyway and reminding them about, you know, sort of what they think.
Yeah, and again, the key theme here is, you know, we may not agree on everything, but we can't stand her.
Right.
And that's basically what you get from the Democrats. I think the Democrats can be more like, hey, we agree on a lot of things, plus we can't let Trump win. And it's going to be an ugly election no matter what. You have two candidates that people just don't like. Right. So it's like choosing between Brussels sprouts and cauliflower.
Ooh, I like both.
You would like both.
I do.
Okay. It's like choosing between A&M and Tech. All right. And so you're left with, wow, which one do I deal with? And so you're like, ooh. The big city life of Lubbock, or the big city life of College Station. Ooh. And so basically, I guess you say, okay, which one has a stronger cow smell? All right, and you know, you're left with that. But again, you're left with two bad choices. Now, moving on from the convention, we want to talk about really, again, a recurring theme, and that is really the community police relations, specifically black community police relations. Now, last week, President Obama, that was beginning, we know about the events in Baton Rouge on Sunday. But before that, President Obama tried to get the ball rolling in terms of trying to heal police community relations. We have a video describing that conference he held at the White House.
Diverse group from all over the country, including Black Lives Matter activists, city mayors, and law enforcement officials. Chief Esterman admits some of them might not have agreed to meet otherwise. But when the President of the United States invites you, you say yes.
It's been a hard week last week.
As he was working through the emotions and effects of last week's events around the country, New Haven Police Chief Dean Esterman got an interesting phone call.
Tuesday morning, my executive assistant walked in and said, "You either have a prank call or the President of the United States is on the phone."
Chief Esterman was on a plane the next day heading to the White House, a part of a small group of activists, community leaders, government, and law enforcement officials invited to a meeting with President Barack Obama about minority communities and police.
He sat down, he took off his jacket, he rolled up his sleeves, he talked for a little while, and then he said, "I want to hear from each and every one of you, and no one's going home until we've talked this through."
The meeting went on for more than 4 hours Wednesday. When it was Chief Esterman's turn to talk, he discussed New Haven's commitment to community policing, how it has worked so far, and how there is still work to be done.
If I want people to feel the pride I'm having and wearing this uniform, and I want them to hear me and see me, then I need to hear them and see them when they express the pain they feel for looking at it.
During a press conference after the meeting, President Obama called it an excellent conversation, but acknowledged none of these problems will be solved overnight.
Not only are there very real problems, but there are still deep divisions about how to solve these problems.
Chief Esterman agrees, but he says the conversation did help him feel better about these issues as he returned to New Haven.
We'll see if it helps America.
So as you see, President Obama tried to get things started in terms of this conversation. So given what happened last week with the Alton Sterling shooting, the Philando Castile shooting, and the events in Dallas, he tried to get the ball rolling. Thursday, he had a town hall type meeting on ABC. I'm not sure how well it was reviewed. Basically, it was people asking the president questions. You had our own Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick there. You have the son of Alton Sterling there. You also had the parents of police officers. You had the police chief from Milwaukee, who actually gave a very strong speech, really pointing out, like, you know, which they pretty much argued like I'm on my own here, as he pointed out the various difficulties he has in dealing with the community, in the sense that there's a level of mistrust, which you said, you know, there's a history behind that. But also talking about the fact that the state legislature is not supportive and of reducing the amount of guns on the streets, and really the variety of problems. And I think in many ways, like what the Dallas police chief said, is like, look, we're overtaxed. We're being asked to do too much, and that, you know, this is about our relationship with the community. We need more action on the part of policymakers to do this. And again, the Milwaukee police chief said, it's like, look, you're going to be out of here in 6 months. But what I hope is, what can you do during the 6 months that you're here? And what do you plan on doing once you leave? I think that's a really important factor there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just speculatively, I wonder to what extent is Barack Obama looks beyond his presidency to what he's going to do. I mean, he's still pretty young as far as sort of people leaving the Oval Office are concerned. And I mean, it seems like this is an area where, you know, he might continue, you know, right, this kind of work, because it's something where he seems to be, I mean, despite his critics, he's actually seems to be pretty strong at these sorts of communications across, you know, lines and different sort of groups of conflict. You know, so to focus again a little more on Baton Rouge, in particular, one of the things that conference was responding to in that sort of evening town hall was the shooting of Alton Sterling by police in Baton Rouge the prior week. So let's see a little bit about that.
Shot fire.
The deadly confrontation between two white police officers and a black man on the streets of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, started with a 911 call just after midnight on Tuesday.
Suspicious call 2 at 2100 on Foster Cross of Fairfield, 7 cities on the corner, gun in his pocket. He pulled a gun on a complainant and told him he couldn't be around there.
Cell phone video shot by a bystander outside the Triple S Food Mart shows the struggle between the officers and Alton Sterling. Witnesses say the officers first tried to use a stun gun against the 37-year-old. He's then pinned against a car and wrestled to the ground. Someone shouts, "He's got a gun." With Sterling on his back, one officer pulls his gun and aims it at Sterling's chest.
So this happened two Wednesdays ago, I think. That was followed by the shooting in Minnesota of Philando Castile on Thursday. The following Sunday was the shooting of police officers in Dallas. Was it Friday?
Friday, yeah.
Friday was the shooting of police officers in Dallas.
And then Sunday was the...
And then this last Sunday was, we're back in Baton Rouge with the shooting of three police officers were shot and killed, and I think another three were injured.
Yes.
And so let's see a little bit about that.
8:40 a.m., a quiet Sunday morning in Baton Rouge, when officers spot a man dressed in black, holding a rifle near a convenience store. Reports received of shots fired.
We have an officer down behind at the pound. We need the Bearcat now for an evac.
Responding officers locked in a gun battle.
All I saw when we pulled up and took a round through the windshield, he had a mask on.
8:48, with medics on the scene, trying to get to the fallen officers.
Officers engaged the subject at that particular time, and he ultimately died at the scene.
The ambush-style attack leaves three officers dead, three others wounded. The shooter, later identified as 29-year-old Gavin Long.
So this is kind of a traumatic event in Baton Rouge. Just as Baton Rouge is trying to heal from the Sterling shooting and then the protest that took place. And again, Baton Rouge has received a bit of pushback in the sense that the police officers were in SWAT gear while they were protesting, as opposed to the Dallas police who were marching with the protesters. There seems to be much more of a standoffish relationship between them. Even the police chief has said, look, you know, we believe there are credible attacks. Some people thought the police chief was being heavy-handed, but then this happens. Now, what's important to note is that Gavin Long is not from the Baton Rouge area. So unlike the shooter in Dallas who was from the area, Gavin Long was from Kansas City and came down to the area. And this has been one of the major concerns about these. This was a major concern in Ferguson that they were having these peaceful protests. The people who were actually doing the rioting were actually from outside of the community. And so this has been one of the major tensions of the people in the community are not able to control what's going on. They're not able to control their interactions because these outsiders are coming in. And again, this goes back to some of the things we talked about in terms of controlling the scope of conflict, that by allowing more people in, well, what happens is sometimes they can kind of take over what you want to do. And you're seeing this happen with a lot of these cases, specifically in this case in Baton Rouge, where somebody from outside of the community decided to basically expand the scope of conflict, to inject himself into the conflict, and in many ways has changed the nature of this conversation. So where you have the police being more tense as well as the community. And I think this is, and again, talking about this idea of a community relationship or trying to heal, you see this person kind of interjected this really at the wrong time as they were trying to go through the healing process, this happens. And a great example of the healing process comes from one of the officers who was killed, Montrell Jackson, who made the following statement on his Facebook page. Well, let's roll that clip.
You know, there's an emotional statement that I want to read to our viewers here in the United States, indeed around the world. The words of Montrell Jackson, one of the police officers who was shot and killed today in Baton Rouge, only 32 years old. He wrote these words on Facebook on July 8th after the Alton Sterling shooting in Baton Rouge. And he writes this: "I'm tired physically and emotionally, disappointed in some family, friends, and officers for some reckless comments. But hey, what's in your heart is in your heart. I still love you all because hate takes too much energy, but I definitely won't be looking at you the same. Thank you to everyone who has reached out to me or my wife. It was needed and much appreciated. I swear to God, I love this city, but I wonder if this city loves me. In uniform, I get nasty, hateful looks, and out of uniform, some consider me a threat. I experienced so much in my short life, and these last 3 days have tested me to the core. When people you know begin to question your integrity, you realize they don't really know you at all. Look at my actions. They speak loud and clear. Finally, I personally want to send prayers out to everyone directly affected by this tragedy. These are trying times. Please don't let hate infect your heart. This city must and will get better. I'm working in these streets, so any protesters, officers, friends, family, or whoever, if you see me and need a hug or want to say a prayer, I got you.
It's a really powerful, message. And I think it really touches on how complicated this all is. Like, you know, we were speaking last night about like what we're going to talk about. And you kind of said, I want to talk about Baton Rouge, but I don't know what I want to say. And I think that's right. Right. I mean, I sort of, you know, when any sort of discussion of, you know, these sort of the sum total of these events going on, whether it's sort of police violence against minority communities or violence against police officers, there's a sort of, you know, there's sort of two basic reactions. One is really, really broad, which is sort of what you're kind of seeing out of a lot of the campaigns as the nature of politics, but to say, you know, it's because everything's going to hell. That's sort of the one reaction. The other reaction you see on television a lot is basically somebody saying something for very particular reasons, as in, you know, this is about topic X. So this is because, you know, we don't have good gun control laws, or this is because we don't have enough guns. And those people are usually, you know, they have a dog in this fight and they're trying to advance their agenda. And the reality is that this is just super, super complicated, right? There's a lot of aspects that are kind of going into what is going on in America right now when you're talking about police and minority community relations. And you could say it's about, you know, the legacies of slavery. You could say it's about, the criminal justice system. You could say it's about, you know, policing. You could say it's about, moral values. You could say it's about psychological constructs like bias, you know, stereotyping and sort of out-group attitudes. But the truth is, it's about all those things, right, in some way or another. And that's why it's hard for people to kind of wrap their mind around and get context for these things. One of the questions I think is interesting that sort of gets at this, it's sort of a dumb question, but it's a good exercise, is like, you know, how much is right now like 1968? And you can talk a little more about 1968, but I mean, it's sort of, the interesting thing about that question, it's a time of, you know, major racial upheaval. And what's sort of the question is dumb because it's not like 1968, but it's smart because it does bring into the fore the fact that there are a lot of elements, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of the 68, multiple things were happening in 68. So you have the assassination of King on April 4th, 1968. Then you have a presidential election where you have Nixon versus Humphrey.
Have the assassination of Kennedy.
Of Bobby Kennedy as well. Kennedy. And so you have really someone, then you also have George Wallace running as well. And so you have really a lot of things going on. And George Wallace is the very strong segregationist argument. Nixon is somewhat kind of moderate on race issues, whereas Humphrey is very liberal on race issues. Humphrey was known as breaking the filibuster in the Senate when Southern senators were trying to block the Civil Rights Act. And so he was Johnson's vice president. Johnson, because of the Vietnam War and some other controversy, decided he wasn't going to run for re-election. So Humphrey runs, but again, you have the strong civil rights candidate, the somewhat moderate, and then the anti-civil rights candidate in Wallace. And you have all these things. So you have a testy election, just much like you have a testy election now. You're coming off of riots in a number of cities. The Watts riots were a few years before that. And so you're really seeing a great deal of tension. Even though you're seeing progress, you see the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, you see the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 65, you're seeing progress, but you're seeing really the early introduction of blacks into politics, specifically in the South. And so you have a lot of these tensions going on. And, you know, one of the things we can look to when talking about this is where you really see the early stages of really the Black Power movement, the Black Nationalist movement, where the Black Panther Party is all of a sudden starting to get more attention. And the Black Panther Party was formed primarily around the idea of stopping police violence in black communities. And it's been well articulated. And what you have here is you have this group of people of African Americans in these various cities, especially these urban areas, northern urban areas, who are very frustrated. One, lack of jobs. Two, and especially the relationship with the police, is that they feel that the police are not there to protect and serve, but to control them. And this is one of the problems you have, which we talked about last week in terms of things like stop and frisk, things of that nature, is that the police are not there to protect and serve, they're there to control. And so this became a big thing where the police were seen as an invading force in their communities. Now, with that said, things are much better than they were in 68. Significantly better. I think President Obama's trying to make that argument when he had his town hall meeting. He's like, yes, things are similar in terms of the tensions that are going on, but things are so much better in the sense that, you know, you have more black elected officials. Blacks are more formally represented formally. However, you still have that pushback. So if you think of Rudy Giuliani's comments regarding Black Lives Matter, if you see some of you see the same pushback you saw in 68, they're just instigators. They don't really have any real arguments there. This is the same argument made about King. It's like, no, he's just causing trouble. And you see the same thing coming out of really with the RNC rhetoric of like, no, there's no real problem here. They're just troublemakers. You're still seeing that rhetoric, but the thing about it, it is much, much better. Now, it's not great, but it's much better. And I think that's one of the things that's important to note is that, you know, and as President Obama said, things aren't going to heal overnight. These are deep-rooted problems. These are deep-rooted animosities. And much like 68, things boiled over. And you saw, again, a number of riots, a number of clashes, you know, hundreds of people dead over that summer. Our hope is that this will not happen again this summer. But again, the tensions that are going on within the U.S. are kind of underlying things of that nature. Again, Donald Trump's making this argument that we're more divided than ever. President Obama's making the argument, no, we're not as divided as it may seem. There are a lot of things that unite us. And again, it makes sense for Donald Trump to make this argument that we're more divided than ever because he's trying to argue like, look, Obama's made things worse. I'm going to make things better. Obama's like, look, no, you know, things aren't as bad as they seem. Look, we're going to get there. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, Hillary Clinton is, you know, more of, and if you think of the rhetoric that she's used, it's much more of, okay, we're going to work together, much more so than Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders had a very us versus them type argument. You see the same thing going on with Trump. But hers is more like, okay, look, no, we're going to try to work together. While she is pointing out certain individuals, she's more of we're going to work together, much more in line with Obama. But again, we're running into these problems of where in 68, we had these very, very strong tensions. You're seeing the same thing going on now. And this has been building for years. It just didn't all of a sudden come up. And you can think about the same thing with the 92 election. So when Bill Clinton won, there's a great deal of racial tension, specifically the Rodney King verdict and the L.A. riots shortly after that, where you had President George Herbert Walker Bush talk about law and order. Even Bill Clinton talked about law and order, but was somewhat sympathetic to the concerns of those in the L.A. riots. And so, again, this is not new at all. 68, 92, 2016, these are things that come about. And you could argue that, you know, elections really make presidential elections, because they last so long and they really can be divisive, may bring a lot of these feelings kind of bring them up, and can be divisive in many ways, specifically with the hyper-partisanship that we're seeing today. And again, if you look at the rhetoric of the convention, it's going to be pretty bad for the Republicans. And then next week for the Democrats, it's going to be just as bad, if not worse. So expect the next 2 weeks to be a bit ugly.
I would say I like relentless.
Yeah, relentless. Yes. Yeah. But I mean, those are things to look forward to. Next week, we'll talk about we'll wrap up some of the things from the Democratic National from the Republican National Convention. We should have a Democratic VP pick by next week. Well, we will have a Democratic VP
pick. By Friday.
By Friday. And we'll talk more about that next week. Thank you all so much for joining us.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.